We sit at the opening moments of Rosh Chodesh Elul, which means that within 3 days we observe the yard site for the 51st time of Rav Kook. Before we actually get to what I would like to do as the core, in view of the fact that it is Rosh Chodesh Elul and 3 days away from that yard site, I would like to take a separate few moments to reinforce for the group around this table that which has become obvious over the last year, and it's difficult to realize that it's been a year that we've been at it, and that is the man's personality. So without looking to this, just take a copy of things that I had cut out from all over, which would give us some reference to the man himself once again. On the right-hand column of the sheet, you have a letter from that he wrote in the first volume of his Igrot, his letters, his collected letters, letter number 53, written to a Rav Avigdor Rivlin, a Rav. It seems as if Rivlin was involved, from the text of the letter, in getting some funds for Rav Kook to publish one of his svarim. Parenthetically, I want to tell you that up until World War II, that was the only way a sefer was published. Here, until the late 1940s, from the beginning of the Passaic community, on record we have about 900 svarim, Sifrei Kodesh, that were subsidized by authors who would, in an itinerant fashion, travel from town to town to be able to get money, ligayis ksafim, to just get money to be able to go and publish. And in the back it was dedicated. Today in America we publish journals that go into the garbage. Up until a little after World War II, this is the way it was. Once again, you see it in the Hasidic community today still, and in Eretz Yisrael, if an author has money and people support him as far as this is concerned, that's it. Very often the Haskoma that you see at the beginning of a Sefer says it is a worthy book, it should be published, buy it so that the next volume can come out. Now this is the circumstances of the background of the letter. And he writes to Rivlin thanking him, beginning with line 3, V'hinei ani malei todah lichvod ahuvi, I am full of gratitude al atzato ha'ne'emana, for his advice, v'al giloto cheftso, and also for having told me, for having revealed to me your chefetz, your desire, liyot li misayeh limlechet shemayim binyinei hadpasal yedei hayoreim sheva Ashkenaz, that you have an in to a certain community in Germany, Yoreim, the Fruma. Okay, this was a segment of the, well, we would call them today the Black Hats of Ashkenaz, okay, who were very much interested in his works. Aval, huh?
That's people from Frankfurt.
Yeah, probably. Frankfurt and to the right, yes. Aval anochi eineni misugal lishum ishtadlut, but I want you to know, I'm appreciative of your entree, but I cannot go ahead and sell myself as a shtadlan. I can't do it. Rak ma sheyazmin Hashem yizbarach berov chasdo al yedei ha'imtzayim ha'mizdamenim. Just whatever falls into my pocket at the chesed of the Kodesh Baruch Hu, b'mahalach shel hashlama ruchanit atzma, as things go on and develop, that's what will be. But I can't go out and campaign, notwithstanding your connections. L'mashal. Now, for an example to just show you, hineni kosef me'od, I die, I yearn, ki nichsof nichsafti, I just yearn constantly. It churns in my kishkes to be able to go ahead and publish lichtov ulahadpis, to write, to author, and to print kifi yecholti, as much as I can, ulai al yedei zeh, and my purpose is this. It isn't, you know, a kind of narcissistic thing to put my name in print. Ulai al yedei zeh yiten Hashem maybe Hashem will grant the Yakibu Ezebale Yechola so that people of means will recognize Shevra'ui L'Sayeyalti, that what I have to say is worthy of support, that I should be able to support, to print more. Shehem etzli ginuzim, and these things are buried, balev, either in my heart, not having written them, or babayit, or at home, I have written them, and they are in manuscript, and I'm waiting, or waiting to see the light of day. Aval, now here is the point. Aval lahatzig atzmi b'tor lochem. If you want me to come and present my writings, and present myself as a warrior, be'et she'ani ohev shalom v'rodefo b'chol levavi v'nafshi, at a time when you know that my essence is not to go out into war, but to bring peace. Okay? If that's what you want, and I'm telling you what he is saying here because you'll soon see it. If that's what you want in order to be able to get money from the Yoreim and Ashkenaz, v'hineni makir, I want you to know, Eretz Yisrael Bifrat, when it comes to Eretz Yisrael especially, ein makom v'derech laharbot perudim. There is no way in the world, there is no place in Eretz Yisrael to inculcate perud, separatists. Now he is obviously saying something to Ashkenaz, to Germany, to Frankfurt, which is a bitter pill to swallow. Shamshon Raphael Hirsch taught that he wanted to break away from the rest of the community and go it on his own. Not all Frum Jews in Ashkenaz, in Germany, agreed with Shamshon Raphael Hirsch. It happened to have been that there was another man, the Würzburger Rav, Rav Bamberger, who was equally the Talmud Chacham, and maybe even greater, Lamdin, than Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch, who did not want to go that route. Shamshon Raphael Hirsch won. Simply by charisma. It was much easier to go it on your own than to go with the reform at that time, in the late 1800s. Much easier to go it on your own. To have to compromise and to have to try to hear what they're saying and still maintain your own integrity, wow, that's a rough deal. But what he is saying here clearly is, I cannot go ahead and write about Eretz Yisrael in the style, in the lingo, that will sell books for you. And your community of Yireim, no question about it, of the people who are frum, and I value that frumkeit, is a community that is built on separatists. We have no room for that in Eretz Yisrael. Now do you understand why people, do you see, in his own words, Don't look to my interpretation or my bent in Rav Kook. These are his own words.
Very clearly.
That's it. There are no two ways about it. And line 10, in the middle of the line, he says, "Afilu l'shem shamayim." Even if you're going to argue the case for me that this separatist activity is l'shem shamayim, it's to build frumkeit, it's the only way to build frumkeit, I cannot do it. Eich efshar sheheyeh niskak lesignon sheenenu kiruchi v'nafshi. How can I go ahead and adopt a style, signon, that isn't my spirit and my soul? It just isn't me. You can't get me to do that which I can't, which is anathema, which is the exact opposite of what I believe. Adarabba. To the contrary, akaveh be'ezrat Hashem, I hope, shebemeshech hazman, that as time passes, yakiru gam kein gidolei hayireim sheba Ashkenaz, that the frum community in Germany and its gidolim will realize shetzarich litzareif ledarkam od haderech hayoter rechava umira, that in addition to what they have accomplished from Shamshon Raphael Hirsch's time on as a separatist community, that they have to add and blend into their philosophy haderech hayoter rechava, a broader way, umira, and ultimately it doesn't mean liberalism, it means to bring greater light and greater intensity of Torah. Shehi mitziata ol v'akidusha genuza b'ma'amakei kol yachid miYisrael. To be able to understand that sitting there in Germany you have a community that is alienated from Torah, and clearly there is a buried kedusha genuza Line 13, B'ma'amakei, in the recesses, in the deep, dark recesses of the heart of Kol Yachid B'Yisrael, every single one, those who are playing the organs and singing with the organs, and the whole works, that's what he's talking about. If you can only understand that they are redeemable, as difficult as it is. Ula hotziala or, and the kunz is, to take that pint of a yid, as you say, Alan, ula hotziala or, and to flame it from a pilot into a full-blown burner, that it should burn all around, bitaha hasa, not giving up your integrity, but with its sanctity, and clear it, cleanse it, mikol hagilulim hanidbakim al yedei magad zarim, all of these foreign elements that have come only because of contact with the goyim. And that was, that was the whole reform. It was nothing more than contact. We want to do to please the goyim, so we'll be able to go ahead and be enlightened human beings and be accepted as emancipated and enlightened human beings. The oz, and if you do go ahead and accept my ways, yechelu alevavot lihitkarev, hearts will start to come together and blend together. Beit Yisrael yihyeh holech v'nivneh, and the house of Israel will go ahead, progressively being built, lihiyot legoy echad, being built into one unit, l'shem Hashem al atmat HaKodesh, for the sake of HaKadosh Baruch Hu on the land of Israel. So you see, he says it in a way that leaves no room for interpretation. I surely would consider it an honor if any one of you would submit this text for official translation that would be acceptable in any court of law. He says it, and that's what it is all about. And this chizayon, this vision, is nothing more than a vision, a reflection of his personality, which cost him a lot of health throughout his years.
What year?
All right, 5,667.
1907.
Okay, how much?
About 1907.
All right.
And when he wrote it?
Yeah.
Samach Zayin.
Samach Zayin is 5,667. Okay.
It's 07.
You got it?
Yeah. 1907.
There you are. This is pre-Balfour Declaration.
That was very early.
World War I? This is a visionary.
It passed away in 1935. Right. So that was many years
before.
See,
so he is a difficult person, Meikara, from the very roots. You cannot contain him in just writing a sefer about Perushim Rashi and Tosfos, or Shilas and Shulas, which he did, in no two ways about it. And that's what you see in the left-hand column here. In a sefer that recently appeared by one of his true Talmidim, Rabbi Moshe Tzvi Neria, in the left-hand column, Chayei HaRa'aya, it's a biographical sketch of 10 years, He writes or reprints a letter on line 28 from Harav Pinchas HaKohen Lintop, Rabba Shel Birj, Lithuanian city of Birj, where Rav Pinchas HaKohen writes to Rav Kook while he was in Yafo. And the important part is just one line in 34. He put out one of his monographs called Ikve Atzon. Bashavua Shava, last week, writes Rav Pinchas, Kibalti Kovetz Ma'amarav B'Shem Ikve Atzon. I received your manuscript, your book, called Ikve Atzon. Toda Rabba al Minchato, and thank you for the present. Kirativ Be'Egyon Leva Nefesh. I read it with concentration of heart and soul, Achat U'Shtayim, not only once, but twice. Right? Umishnes simcha samachti alav. And it was a double measure of simcha that I was overjoyed with in having to read it. Ki amnam, and here is the point, zachinu ligibor chayel. In you, we see an incredible hero, asher lo pachad al nafsho, who has absolutely no fear, latzeit al sdei ma'arechet hasifrut, v'panim chadashot v'tochnit chadasha. You have absolutely no fear at the beginning of the 20th century to go ahead and to innovate Because any innovation in the 19th century and in the beginning of the 20th century, you know the famous statement of the Chassam Sofer, Chodosh, anything that's new is also min haTorah, is also. There can't be anything new that should be kosher. And here he comes not only with substance, but with form that is so new and that is so different that you've got to consider him the most incredible hero on the Orthodox scene. You were saying, Joel.
The Chassam Sofer really used that in that
He way? Used it, yes, without question. Needless to say, it was a double entendre.
Yeah.
I mean, okay. Well, but that's a famous one. Yeah, no question about it. It is ascribed to him, but look, listen to me. Chassam Sofer... The Chassam Sofer does battle at a time when life is bleak, so he has to use such a thing. He has to give such statements. Now, furthermore, if you look below line 47, the author of this Chayei HaRayah, Rav Moshe Tzinaria, goes ahead and quotes a sofer, an author, Ayin Zayin Rabinovich. I don't know. I am not familiar with him. I don't know who he is. He may be from, he may not be from. It's irrelevant. But in line 48 he says, Bichlal shanehu haraya bedarko. Rav Kook is entirely different in Derech HaKodesh me ha-orthodoxia ha-pachdanit. From the fearful orthodoxy. And what is that fearful orthodoxy? The chas v'sholom, anything is slightly off-center is already treif. It cannot be, there is no such thing that you should be different and innovative and it should be kosher. Sheyireh mikol tzad shel hitkadmut, that he takes a look here, Rav Kook, takes a look at every step of progress, ubakol hiro'er rakeres v'avon. Orthodoxy sees nothing more, I'm sorry, I have to reread that. Sheyirei'ah, that orthodoxy is afraid, mikol tzad shel hitkadmut, of any and every kind of progress, any step, ubakol hiro'a rakeres v'aven, and any kind of change has to be destructive and pernicious.
Why mess around with a good thing?
You're right. However, that is what was called into question, whether it was a good thing. And you see, and here, if we were to write a psychological analysis of the 19th century, we've got to realize that we were doing nothing more than trying to choose whether the turtle shell of ghetto and conservative small c is going to preserve us, or do we have to float with the winds? Similar to Rabbi Akiva, who clearly told Rabbi Gamliel that the one thing that allows Klal Yisrael in the time of Tanoim to be able to survive is to be able to float with the waves, not lose your integrity, stay on top of it. But there are things that are up and things that are down, things that change, and ultimately the Torah does survive. Now, this is a classical machlokis that has been going on for God knows how long. But you are assuming that the 19th century and its styles, its religious and social institutions would. You're assuming that, because how could it be bad? However, they were good only insofar as those who wanted to adhere to it. What about the overwhelming majority who felt that it was not only not good, but it was debilitating? How do we reclaim them? And this is the difference between Rav Kook and the rest of the firm world. He felt that reclamation not only was possible, but was an imperative, whereas they felt you're a shagetz, forget about it. There's no, what, look, a shagetz, and forget it, and that's all.
Excuse me, I think that the community to whom Rav Kook was addressing his hopes and desires, well, the sort of modernization wasn't new, emancipation wasn't new at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century. Zionism was what was new. And I think what Rav Kook was relating to, and this advancement this moving forward of the Jewish people that he's referring to doesn't refer particularly to secularization, but to the new trends of Zionism that were looking up in the community. Secularization was present since the 16th, 17th century in Poland and all.
You know, it would be easy to say, and it's something that I've grappled with. It would truly be easy to say that Rav Kook is trying to find a midpoint between the secular Zionism and the political Zionism of Herzl, and something which is authentic. Okay. However, when you look at what he writes before Herzl comes on the scene, he writes in the same way. Save for certain situations that he has to address, certain historical realities that he has to address. But he is consistent before Zionism, and I'm using 1897 as that, and after Zionism. He learned his Zionism before Herzl in the Yeshiva in Volozhin. He learned it from the Netziv. And the Netziv writes the same way as he does, just the Netziv writes as a Litvish Shiva, and he, Rav Kook, writes with the impact of Lithuanian Torah, but with a Hasidic Kabbalistic kind of approach. I'm grappling with this. I hear what you're saying. I don't know that he floated with the winds. I really don't know. Surely not in the letter in 1907 here to this Rabbi Avigdor Rivlin, where he's not talking Zionism. He is talking something far more fundamental to him, and that is Perud Levavot. Simple as that. It's not Zionism. It's not whether I go with Achadam, or Aleph Dalet Gordon, or Lilienblum, or Smolenskin, or Herzl. These things don't exist for him. I want a totality of an I need a gush. I need a togetherness. But we can argue that probably for the length of our shiur without coming to any real conclusions, other than I wanted to say that you see once again his personality is almost sui generis. He is one and alone as far as all of this is concerned. Rab Simcha Wasserman Shlita, whom I had discussed certain things, certainly he knew of Kook, with, he characterized it in a very interesting way. Rab Simcha is the only living son of Rab Elchanan Wasserman. He said that Rab Kook never got over his fantasias, over his fantasies. Simple as that. Well, Rab Simcha is a true Litvish Rosh Hashiva. There are no two ways about it. So that any kind of Chassidische or Kabbalistic intonations have got to be fantasies, you see. And maybe even hallucinations. But this is Rav Kook. Remember that on his father's side, he was a Lithuanian Rosh Hashiva. On his mother's side, he had Chassidish blood in him. His father wanted him to be a Rosh Hashiva. His mother wanted him to be a big Rebbe. And he combined the two. He truly combined both. So therein, to be able to juggle both of these worlds and do it effectively, in and of itself, says what it has to be said about his personality. Zechusa Yogein Aleinu, in the hope that he can enlighten for us a better year than we had last year. All right. Now, last year Rosh Chodesh Elul, so obviously we spoke about Tshuva. But Tshuva is only one of three in the concomitants of the Elul season. It's Tshuva, Tefillah, and Tzedakah. I'd like to take a look at some of the insights that Rav Kook gives as far as tefillah is concerned. They're going to be very difficult. Difficult not because of the language, that in and of itself is going to be a difficulty, but difficult because we are grappling with a concept that Gevald, we still don't know what it's all about. We don't know, and we're all in the boat together. We do not know what davening is all about. No matter how slow you go, no matter how fast you go, no matter how much you daven, no matter how often you daven. Now, needless to say, Rav Kook is going to say it in his way, in his inimitable fashion, by delineating some of the problems. But before we get to Rav Kook and all of his Kabbalah, in the words of Rav Simcha, all of his fantasias, his fantasies, before we get there, I must share with you a piece that was written 250 years before the Shulchan Aruch. It was written in the Torah. The Torah was no Kabbalist. He was not. He certainly was not a Chassidish Rebbe. It didn't exist. A Shtreimel and a Gartel didn't exist in the mid-1300s. Okay? Let's just take a look at it and use that as the springboard to what I want to... What I want to show you in Rav Kook, and hopefully we'll spend a couple of sessions on it and see what we can do with it. Go ahead.
Has anyone ever done, you know, any kind of like study on the Torah in terms of the this kind of material, like I don't know what to call it, except machshavadik material that's in the Torah.
To my knowledge. Not to my knowledge. You'd be on dangerous ground, because machshavadik material in the Torah is halacha. It's not hardcore.
But it's not. It doesn't tell you put on your lecture before you wake up. I mean, it's this kind of thing.
Not to my knowledge. This is a selection of the tour, which speaks about some of the prerequisites of tefillah. And here, the prerequisite in this siman is machshava, the mental process. Machshava ketzad. Before you come to daven, there has to be a certain mental preparation. The Tanya we learned in a Braisa Mispalel, one who comes to daven tzarich sheyechaven libo. You have to go ahead and have kavona of heart. So machshava and kavona are simply synonymous. Mm-hmm. Next time, in Yirtzeh Hashem, I'll take you through the word kavona and show you what he does. We're going to learn it from two perspectives, from one of his rebbes, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, on Kavana and what he does with it. Okay? But for now, Tzarech Sheyechaven Libo, you have to go ahead and have Kavana of heart, concentration of heart, Sheneemar, as the Pasuk says, quote, Tachin Libam, you must prepare your heart. Takshivos Necha, and then your ears will hear. Perush, meaning, Sheyechaven Perush HaMilot, that you have to be intent with the meaning of the words shemotzi bisfasov, that you utter from your lips, v'yachshov, and as you daven, understanding what you're saying, yachshov ki'ilu shchina kinegdo, you must picture that the shchina is right in front of your face, shenemar, as it says, quote, shivisi Hashem lenegdo tamid, I have imagined that God stands right opposite me. The Ya'ira Kavana, and you have to work at it, La'ir, to awaken this orientation. The Yasir Kola Machshavot HaTodot, HaTodot Oto, you must get rid of and blank out all of the thought processes that are going to burden you in the process of Kavana. Ad Shetisha'er Machshavto VeKavanato Zaka B'Tfilato, until your thoughts and your heart's intent is purely focused on tefillah, v'yachshov, thinking ki ilu haya medaber lifnei melech basav adam, that if you were to talk to a king, queen of England, shehayom kan ulmachal bakever, tomorrow she may die, is misader dvarav, surely if you're going to speak, you're going to practice the speech, u'mechavein bahem yafeh, you're going to make sure to be intent in everything that you say, leval yikashel, I think it should be chesvav, chas v'shalom lifnei melech. Leval yikashel, is kal v'chomer, all the more lifnei melech, malchei amlachim HaKadosh Baruch Hu. All the more that you have to do this when you go and speak to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. She tzarich lechavein af machshavto, Ki lefanav ha-machshava k'dibur. Every thought is considered as if you have spoken. Ki kol ha-machshavot u-choker, because what you think is known. V'chein, and here is where we come to an interesting finale. V'chein hayu osim chasidim v'anshei ma'aseh. And this is what the Gemara means of what the Hasidim Rishonim and people who were capable of doing such things, anshei ma'aseh, who were bekoach to do these, shehayu mitbodedim, when they would go into seclusion, umechavnim bitfilatan, and would go ahead and intently concentrate on tefillah, ad to the extent shehayu magiim lihitpashtut hagashmiut, that they were able to separate themselves from anything which is physical, ulehitgabrut ruach hasichlit, and be able to give the neshama ruach hasichlit, the spirit, the upper hand, ad shehayu magiim karov lemaalat hanevuah, to the point that whatever happened to them, they almost reached a level of
nevuah,
of being in the state of prophecy. That is probably one of the most difficult lines that you can learn in any text on tefillah. I don't know that it's in the Shulchan Aruch. In this, he quotes it identically?
Almost, I think.
Okay. Alright. But its authorship is the Tur. I'm asking you clearly to be patient with me as I talk to myself. I come to shul, some good shuls, some better shuls, and I daven with a minyan, whether it is Shachris, Mincha, or Maariv, and this is what I am capable within the context of American shuls, including Borough Park, and this is what I am capable of doing, reaching a point of intense concentration so that I forget about my car, my home, the humidity in my basement which has caused mildew on my sarim and eating my kishkis out, the safer that I lent to someone and I don't know where it is, whether my wheels are aligned or not, if it's going to rain, can I get to the cleaners? I'm forgetting all of this, the heck with money, Hashem Yisbarach b'chasto ha-gadol will make sure that everything will be okay, the works, don't worry, I'm able to strip myself of all of these problems, my children and my children's children and my in-laws and my parents and those who are well and those who are not well, strip myself of everything until I have nothing more than my neshama. And what does my neshama want other than ki nichsof nichsafti, to reach out and kiss its author, its mate, and that's HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Come on, guys, when's the last time? This morning, right? That's the way you davened, huh? That's the way you davened. And don't tell me that it happened in a yeshiva. Don't tell me.
Who davens this way now? I mean, which shul davens this way?
And don't worry about shuls. I'm interested. Shuls don't daven.
I mean, the
people daven.
He doesn't talk about a shul.
Right. It's a personal exercise. Is this what, even when we come to daven 15 minutes earlier, some of you I look at and I stand with awe and amazement. There's a simple Jew who, for God knows how long, as long as I know him, will always come a half an hour earlier, sometimes 20 minutes earlier, only to be able to say the brachas word for word, and whatever he can of kabbonis, to be able to say word for word. No? And I rush in, and I have to be a traffic cop, and I have to be a stage manager, and a production assistant, and so on and so forth. This is the way we do it. You see, so what I am saying, and here is the point, that if you want to pick one of the most difficult mitzvahs in the entire book. It is the mitzvah of tefillah. Okay? It is for that reason that Rav Kook had so much to say about it, to the extent that his son was capable of putting together a two-volume Perush on Siddur, which Rav Kook never wrote. He never wrote a Perush on Siddur. But to take from all of his works all of the references to the various psukim and the kavonas and the intent, there was enough to put together two volumes. Two volumes of Perush on Siddur. And in this little brochure that you have in front of you, Rav Kook's son does nothing more than give you an introduction in several pages to various inyonim that were written at different times and were put together piece by piece. Let's start to get at it. The Siddur is with a parish called Olat Re'iya.
You could reach this kind of right?
Yeah.
You know, he said to me on Rosh Hashanah, well, once a week on Shabbos, maybe I could attempt to prepare myself. I'm not saying succeed, but I could try. It seems to me three times a day, 7 days a week, even these people didn't do it back then. I mean, in our modern life, we have to go into isolation. You can't.
I grant what you're saying is correct. However, what we may be doing is only practicing all year for an infinitesimal moment at Nila, let's say. And when suddenly the neshama wants to burst forth and you feel it with a kind of tingle from head to toe.
So you're saying this is not all year round, really. This is to prepare us for that one.
No. I am not conceding to you that it is impossible. You see, it is possible all the time, but tell me something. If I were to hand you a violin and tell you now to play Tchaikovsky's concerto on it, you would do it, right?
But the everyday davening is not per se, it's to lead up to that.
Well, it may just be that everyday davening will lead up to your high points. However, if you look at it from a perspective of davening, the Shema Yisrael that you say tonight on a simple Rosh Chodesh Elul is no different than the Shema Yisrael that you say at Nila. Elama, you've been using it as a practice. You've been using it as a, you know, you've been practicing it. You were saying.
No, I was going to say, this kind of thing seems to me like really impossible without somebody really training himself in like meditational
techniques. Without question. But to say that we are going to establish as the criterion the davening that we do today is the biggest self-bluff that could exist.
Yeah.
The biggest self-bluff. Now, the Rambam already felt this problem. In Yetzer Hashem, when we meet next time, you know, Abba Aleinu Letova, I will show you, by starting at a Rambam, at what seemingly is a contradiction in two halachos in the Rambam, the way Rab Chaim deals with it, and show you how he goes ahead and puts Rav Kook, how he puts his two cents in on the same machlokas. But no one is going, you see, what the Torah is telling you, that this is a sine qua non. You must have this. What the Torah is telling you is that you may have to work an entire lifetime on it. An entire lifetime. Simple. Let's therefore begin by indicating in Rav Kook's words what tefillah is not. Take a look, please, page 3. The third page, and we'll start in, you know, Rambam style by saying what tefillah is not. line 79, right at the top. Says Rav Kook, "Lifnei atfila tzarich la'agish et atzorech shel atfila." The first thing, before you even open your mouth to daven, you have to feel the need to daven. Ve'et ha'oneg shel atfila. And the joy that will accrue from having that need filled. Okay? For some crazy reason, I came in late tonight. I was stuck in traffic. And it must have been the last minute. Someone was having a barbecue, and it filtered, the winds filtered through the windows, and it smelled great. I came into the house, and I had this urgent, burning need after having eaten everything that I would want to have a steak. I was sitting there talking to Leah and talking to Adina. We were eating away, and I'm opening up the refrigerator. I kid you not, this didn't happen more than an hour and a half ago. What are you looking for? I said, I'm looking for a steak. But there are no steaks here, and you don't eat steaks. Es nicht kein Fleisch, you don't eat any meat. What are you looking? And you're right, I closed the refrigerator, and that was it. And I had some more salad, cucumbers and tomatoes, and finished, and that's all, and I came here. Hatzorech shel hatfila, the needs for davening. We have that kind of need, ve'et ha'oneg shel hatfila, and the enjoyment that we have from davening, maybe once a year, twice a year, occasionally. When I got finished with last year's Nila, after not having been in shul all of Yom Kippur, having been sick, and suddenly realizing at 4 o'clock-ish that it's over. The 24 hours have passed and the virus is gone. And I came and I saw that my feet were holding me and I was able to walk up to Nila. There was a burning need that I had to daven because I did not daven Kol Nidre Ma'ariv at home. I was out like a light. I don't remember anything of Shacharis, nothing of Musaf. And the only thing I walked into was Mincha Nila. That was it. It was a need that I had to daven. It was a kind of a need that I don't know that occurs every single day. And then, after having been able to complete the nila that I did, there was a feeling of accomplishment, of that need gratification had taken place. Okay? Today, what we need is to get our kid out of the house so that our wife can have a little oneg Shabbos, a little rest. Simple as that. Let's go on. Ein hatfila chafitza. He says, right off the bat, if you come to daven, I want to tell you that davening, by definition, does not want l'shanot shum davar be'elokut, to change anything in God, shehi mekor hanitzchiyut, which by definition is the source of eternity. Ve'eina begeder ha'hishtanut, and God does not change. Alright, do I have any comments over here? When you pray, when you daven for the well-being of someone, you are not changing God's mind. If chas v'shalom, someone is laying in the hospital, and that someone is sick, and you are asking for a refuah shlema, you are not saying, says Rav Kook, that Hashem, up until now, he's been a bad boy or a bad girl, and you're punishing him. Please stop punishing him and change your mind. Stop afflicting him. That is not your davening.
Isn't there a concept of davening?
So what are you davening for?
Everything in one shot, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, he obviously will answer, but let's turn the tape over. Please. Go ahead. I'm serious, because what you're saying is very profound.
I was interested by Rav Kook's use of the word onik in describing the field. Particularly, I think it's described by Yom Kippur, which is the Yom Simcha. Again, afterwards, is the Tfila though an onic experience throughout the rest of the time?
Let me tell you this: all of life for Rav Kook is a Yom Kippur experience. That's where the problem is. We don't view that our every contact with life as a fusion